everybody out there, everybody, and thanks for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. I am Cam Hale, and as always, sitting across from me right now is the birthday boy. I had a little birthday party for him this weekend. Right. It's Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Thanks to everyone for sending me the birthday wishes. I normally don't like having a birthday, especially one where you turn 40.
When you have a zero at the end of your number. Yeah, that's never good.
But I had a good time. You know, it really did. This week, I had a couple things go wrong.
A couple. This whole week was a train wreck.
Between flat tires and rainout games. It's been a mess. But, you know, the culmination of Saturday night with meeting with old friends and stuff was really fun. So I'm glad we got to do it. Me and Cam, we went to... What kind of restaurant is that?
I don't really know what.
I don't know. It's a Brazilian. It's a Brazilian type of restaurant where they bring around like huge scours of meat on these swords, different animals, whether it's, you know, cow or goat or chicken or pork.
If you're a vegan or vegetarian, you will hate us and not like that place because they carry it around and carve off whatever you want. But then they got massive salad bars. It was a good time. We had a good time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we stopped by a little beer garden here in town and. Well, we didn't tell Kyle because we had about 30 friends show up, and they were all lingering, waiting whenever we got there. So
yeah, it's pretty cool.
We had a really, really good time. I survived the coast, folks. For those of you that aren't Elite fans, I didn't drown. I didn't get eaten by a shark, although I had some touch-and-go episodes down there and scared me a little bit. But other than that, I'm great. You know, I'm not going to lie. Other than that, I'm okay. All's well. But we are here to get back into the groove, to get the show rolling again. We're back in our flow now, folks. I've got something to show you. Now, Kyle, look. I was telling you a little bit of something because I had no idea of what a desert kite was. Folks, I found this. I was talking about desert kites. Undoubtedly, you got to picture this. Sometimes you can imagine as a hunter back in the days, it might have been hard to get within distance of the animal that you're trying to shoot with, whether it be with a bow, atlatl, sticks, and, you know, whatever you got. So now you've got to imagine Central Asia. And they said that this actually comes from Uzbekistan. And it's desert kites in Central Asia. And what it is it's these large archaeological structures that they believe have dated back as to the Iron Age in this very remote part of the world. And what they are is basically piled up rocks and earth. And you can see them from space. You see them from the skies. You look down on them. There's these strange geometric patterns in these grasslands. And they go on for like a half a mile or more. And the author even calls, this is from National Geographic's news, and he talks about he was walking out there when they were doing a global project for retracing, say, the first humans out of Africa. And he said he was sitting on these ruins and never really realized what they were.
Right.
But when you start looking at them from space and all this, this is what it is. It's a trap to trap the animals so you can pretty much herd them into an area and then lead them to slaughter so you can
kill them. Like a bottleneck?
What it is exactly. Imagine this, if you will, folks. It's like a horseshoe. It's wide. It's a wide horseshoe open on the bottom part of the U. All right. And then up by the ends where it gets smaller, there's these little cells, like little holding pens. And what they do is they would build them around, instead of being herded, they would build them around migratory routes. So the animals was naturally migrating and they would start off with the wall real small, like only 6 inches of rock.
You wouldn't notice it.
You wouldn't notice it. As you walked, it got taller, like you're walking through a cavern system. You're bebopping down through there. Next thing you know, you're in these areas where they're trapped in these high wall areas, and the hunters are just there waiting for you to stumble in there. Well, then in a panic, you don't know which way to go, the animal, and then they get them.
Man,
so basically,
that's
they
clever.
Shoot them in from above. It is a heck of an idea, but what's wild is they think, and it's some other reading and stuff, that they believe that this has been passed on for years and years and years. Like, this dates back to the Iron Age, but they believe that it may have been done, maybe possibly by prehistoric man. Now, it doesn't talk about it in this article so much, but there's other articles that you can see that they believe that some of this may have been tricks passed on for a long, long time. The coolest part, though, is that if you go to the article, you can see it where they've kind of got it traced out to where it's these old migratory routes, and then you can see the way they've built them. It's still there today.
That's
so
cool.
It's just, man, look, I get a kick out of it, the whole idea of thinking of how, because you hear these tales of, like we've even discussed, with the woolly mammoths, and people have even said, oh, well, they were all wiped out by human hunters. Well, you got to imagine what they were hunting with. Like, I don't know about that, because, I mean, how would you wipe them out, not something else?
Yeah.
But this is neat to think about how, because, like we've discussed, you've got a stick bow to start with. How far could you accurately shoot a stick bow? Then you've got to think about what these guys have got. Maybe it's not the same pound. You know what I mean? There's a lot of stuff.
There's
a lot of variables. So you're still talking about max range of 40 yards at best. And I know lots of them would probably stick them and would just track them, would follow them until the animal exhausted.
You're not talking about modern day compound bows.
No,
you're talking
no.
about very primitive stick bows. Yes. How many people out there actually have shot in a bow? How many people are actually listening to this
yes.
are archers? You know, if you haven't tried to use an actual just recurve or a long bow or something, it's not that easy. And they aren't talking about hitting a flat target. Now you got to throw in the element of actually hunting, stalking an animal. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows who's spent any time in the woods doing something similar, that it's no easy feat. So for them to develop this way of luring these animals into an area to help them, you know, have a better chance
yeah.
of harvesting that animal, that's really ingenious. It's pretty neat. I love stories like that.
This is what's wild is they didn't realize just how successful these were till they went to doing some digs around there. And they came up with thousands of discarded foot bones of the butchered antelope in that area. And they even believe that these traps were used so well that basically it decimated the Persian gazelle group of gazelles
wow.
down there. Yeah, just wiped them out because they would, just like we talked about, stumble down in on a migratory path and then get hammered.
That is pretty cool. Well, check this out over here on sciencealert.com. Last Sunday, Scotland achieved something great. For the first time on record, Cam,
yes.
wind power alone generated 106% of Scotland's electricity needs in a single day. Now, the
wow.
environmental group, the WWF Scotland, has just confirmed that on August 7th, 2016, wind turbines in Scotland pumped 39,545 megawatt hours of electricity into the national grid. Now, they say while the nation's homes, businesses, and industry only needed 37,202 megawatts. They go on to say that while it's not impossible that this has happened in the past, it certainly is the first time since we began monitoring the data in 2015 that we've had all the relevant information to be able to actually confirm it. Now, WWF Scotland director Lang Banks told the Associated Press that on the path to fully renewable future, this certainly marks a significant milestone. So, this all sounds awesome, right? But there's a little catch to this story.
Uh-oh.
It was very, very windy that day. Now, Mr. Lang Banks even goes on to say that it was a particularly windy day, and to say that alone is an understatement. He says it was chaos. The winds were reaching speeds in up to 115 miles per hour in some parts of the country, forcing bridges to close, trains to be delayed, and ferries canceled. Power was cut in parts of Dundee, Scotland's fourth biggest city, and a 17,000-ton oil rig was ripped from its tug and actually floated to shore. It was also a Sunday, which means businesses and industry facilities would have required a whole lot less energy than a normal busy work day. So just bear that in mind. So although that they were able to generate from wind power alone enough electricity to supply the whole nation,
mm-hmm.
that's incredible, but it was a very unnormal.
Still a step in the right direction.
Right, absolutely. It was a very windy day.
A play on word. Like, I'm the world's smallest giant.
Right. So, you know,
I got you.
The ability of the country to even to achieve that shows that this renewable energy is a viable form of replacing, you know, fossil fuels. So that's pretty cool. They said that they're not the only country in Europe that's been doing this. Germany's been moving ahead, as well as some others. And they think that by the year 2030, they'll have their wind generators perfected so much that they will be able to generate 100% of Scotland's electrical needs just from wind power alone.
That's crazy.
That's cool, right?
I like that, yeah.
I mean, they has a huge wind farm. What was it, Brownwood? It's not that far from here.
Mm-hmm.
You
there's
constantly
a lot of
see them
West
being trucked
Texas,
over
yeah.
there. So how cool is that? And there's little people that have their own private ones, and they actually sell electricity back to the city.
Yes.
That's pretty cool, right?
It's something that I think it's going to end up becoming more and more popular, like solar power, that we're going to get further and further away as best we can.
I hope so.
For anybody listening to this, if you hear my voice right now, look at your reflection, look in a mirror, look at anything right now, folks. You don't have to go to school to be a physicist anymore, folks. You are a physicist. You're an intuitive physicist. And this comes from Gizmodo. Now, scientists are claiming this. And what you're asking, what's an intuitive physicist? Well, basically, what they're working with right now is the fact that a human brain can swerve obstacles in the road when you're just, you know, almost like you zone out, boom, you instantly react, you duck whenever you see something in your peripheral vision, you move and all that. That's a type of physics that your brain is dealing with. And what scientists are doing with that physics, they've actually called it the physics engine that the brain works with. They're studying that part of the human brain to try to help design better robotics. That's what they're going for. Yes, because they say what we do is it's constantly our brain is running. Now, we don't even realize this. Simulations of a scan of our environment. So while you're walking and what you see, without knowing it, your brain is running a simulation of what it would feel like to step up on that curb. How much, because like we've always said, how do you know how much force to pick up your cup with? You don't squeeze it with all your might. Instantly, your hand knows exactly how much to do it with.
Yeah.
It's because it's run simulations hundreds of thousands of times. And you've done it since you were a child, you learned. Because as a baby, when you hand a baby, when I say baby, we're talking a toddler, can't speak just yet, toddling around. If they've got a sippy cup or, you know, they have a death grip on it. Like you try to pull something out of their hand.
Yeah.
It's because they don't really know how hard to hold on to things, that you don't need to waste that energy. That's what they're talking about. Now, they say that this is actually a metaphor. It's drawn from the world of video games. It's a software designed because it's there to simulate, like, the space of games in there. So you can get in there and monk around with it, like car crashes, moving targets, all of these things. But that's what they're talking about. Jason Fisher is the lead author on this, and he's a cognitive scientist at Johns Hopkins University. Gizmodo interviewed him, and he says that I think every person is an outstanding intuitive physicist owing to a lifetime of interacting with the world and learning the rules of how it unfolds over time. He goes on to say, especially as a consequence of one's own intervention in it. And he says that the network of brain regions we uncovered may be involved in the learning or application of those rules.
That's cool.
So they have a series of tests that they've been hooking up to people and letting them give it out, you know, try it out. He says that, let's get one caveat out of the way. It's a bit misleading to talk about anything in the terms of this is where X happens in the brain. We are not talking about a single brain region here. Says, I see physical scene understanding as a highly integrative process that sources information from many brain areas working in concert. Now, we've discussed this, you and I off air talked about, you know, how do they know exactly, like, this one right here controls what your hands do.
Right.
This one, it's not. It's the brain working like a processor. It's drawing information from all these different areas before it makes a conclusion and allows you to be able to do it. So what they're doing now is they've actually been putting people through these small tests with these scanners on their head and letting them, and it's just simple tests of watching things being done on television, doing things in a game, little things like that to watch what lights up in your brain. And that's what they're going to start using, much to the chagrin of myself, to start trying to program robots
right.
better so they can in turn learn to interact with their environment with the same speed that we interact with. So I always think about, you see the fact of the guy runs up, tries to kick over the dog robot, or they
right.
swing that. Well, now, if I ran up and tried to kick you, you would instantly, instinctively jump out of the way. Well, now, instead of the robot worrying about balancing, he instantly, instinctively jumps out of the way.
Man.
They're getting
quicker. They're getting stronger.
Exactly. Terminator.
Becoming more lethal. That's
Terminator.
Right.
That's it.
Our friend over at Phantoms and Monsters, Lon Strickler, just posted something pretty interesting about Foo Fighters. Now, of course, almost everyone listening to this knows that Foo Fighters were used as Allied aircraft pilots in World War II to describe various UFOs or mysterious aerial phenomenon seen in the skies over both the European and Pacific theaters of operations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the term Foo Fighter was actually coined by the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, and these were reported from November 1944 onwards, and they were reportedly all through World War II. Witnesses often assumed that the Foo Fighters were secret weapons employed by the enemy, of course, but they remained unidentified post-war. And were reported both by Allied forces and Axis forces. These Foo Fighter experiences of Allied pilots were taken very seriously, they say, and most of the information about the issue was never released by the military intelligence. So he gives a couple of encounters in there, so I'm going to read two of these, and if you want to read the rest of them, you'll have to go over to his website, Phantoms and Monsters. I'll put links in it in the show notes. The first one happened on May 1944 at Clovis Army Airfield, New Mexico. It was about 10 a.m. in the morning until about 11:30 a.m., three of us, all B-29 engineering officers in the Air Corps, observed this object. The day was warm and totally clear. The object was at 11 o'clock high. It never wavered. It just sat there. Remember, in 1944, UFO was a term unknown to us. It was not used until much later. We theorized that it might be a Japanese balloon, but it never moved. It was shining brightly, but the sun surely was farther away. How could that be? Later, I became aware that some people seemed to see them glow. That bothered me. For over 50 years, I took the pains to liken it to one of the several new-from-the-factory bright B-29 bombers that had just come to the field. We had 60 planes, more or less. It appeared to be about the size of a dime on a 14-foot-high ceiling. Now remember, we were young, trained observers in perfect physical condition. We were qualified to fly. Over the years, I have watched UFO stories on TV and elsewhere, never having an answer. Always just more questions. I don't know any more now than I did on that day in 1944. I spent over 40 years as a professional engineer, performing structural design for all types of structures. I am a highly experienced engineer, and I look hard and long at something before expressing an opinion. Where do we go from here? I'm used to scoping something out and least coming up with my opinion. What does this scope work? Somewhere we have to form an opinion and get over with the exercise. I'm 85 and a half years young, with all the smarts I ever had, I believe. We cannot keep going on and on. As you can see, I don't have that luxury. But one thing I can say to you is that we, for the first time in our history in 1943 through 1946, had about six B-29 fields in a 400-mile radius with 60 very active aircraft on each one. Just think about it. This was at Clovis Army Airfield, only 200 miles from Roswell. How does that grab you? We went to the officers' club for lunch, and it was gone. And we returned to the flight line. So that's a pretty crazy story, right? By an experienced engineer and pilot back then. Not somebody that's unlikely, along with his, you know, fellow workers and countrymen, to all mistaken this. And what could it be?
And he's aggravated because he's run out of time and hadn't learned any more about it after all these years.
That's exactly right. Here's another one. This is from Stephen J. Brickner, who's a sergeant with the 1st Marine Division. And he had a fantastic encounter with the mysterious aerial objects. It goes like this. He says, the sightings occurred on August 12, 1942, about 10 in the morning, while I was in the bivouac with my squad on the island of Tulagi in the southern Solomons, west of the Guadalcanal. It was a bright tropical morning with high banks of white, fleecy clouds. I was cleaning my rifle on the edge of my foxhole when suddenly the air raid warning was sounded. There had been no condition red. I immediately slid into my foxhole with my back to the ground and my face turned up to the sky. I heard the formation before I saw it. Even then, I was puzzled by the sound. It was a mighty roar that seemed to echo in the heavens. It didn't sound at all like the sewing machine drone of Japanese airplanes. A few seconds later, I saw the formation of silvery objects directly overhead. At this time, I was in a highly emotional state. It was my fifth day in combat with the Marines. It was quite easy to mistake anything in the air for Japanese planes, which is what I thought these objects were. They were flying very high above the clouds, too high for a bombing run, especially on our little island. Someone shouted in a nearby foxhole that they were Japanese planes searching for our fleet. I accepted this explanation, but with a few reservations. First, the formation was huge. I would say well over 150 objects were in it. Instead of the usual tight V of 25 planes, this formation were in straight lines of 10 to 12 objects, one behind the other. The speed was a little faster than Japanese planes, and they were soon out of sight. A few other things puzzled me. I couldn't seem to make out any wings or tails. They seemed to wobble slightly, and every time they wobbled, they would shimmer brightly from the sun. Their color was like highly polished silver. No bombs were dropped, of course. All in all, it was the most awe-inspiring yet frightening spectacle I've seen in my entire life. Now that's pretty cool, his sighting. You know what it reminded me of? When we were at the Ozark Mountain UFO conference, mm-hmm. Marler, remember those videos he was showing, some of those pictures?
Yes.
They were in a formation like that, lined up, right?
Yes.
That's immediately what I thought
of. It sounds like that. All of it sounds like that's exactly what was going on.
And
that's crazy.
Very interesting.
I love that.
If you'd like to go over and read some more of those stories, like I said, I'll put links in the show notes, or just go over to phantomsandmonsters.com.
Well, all right, folks. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'm going to be talking about, I guess you could get into a little history of maybe one of my favorite stories, or at least links to stories and tales ever, and it's most people seem to enjoy too. And that's the tales of the little people in the woods. We've got another little branch of those people we're going to get into, and we're going to come back after the break with some stories of the Pukwudgie. That's right, more Pukwudgie madness, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. For centuries, modern man has been fascinated by the tales of the little people of the woods. And this fascination has grown and stayed part of our folklore to modern times as well. Now, mainly, it seems to be because of the great stories and unique encounters that this tiny cryptid creature has taken hold of our hearts and minds. The idea of a little couple living simply in the woods, only taking what the land provides, and existing in harmony with nature. And this is the dream, it seems, that we all secretly yearn for. Well, one such story of a place like that is Haunchville. Now picture, if you will, a barely noticeable gravel road deep in the woods, overgrown with trees on either side. It instantly strikes you that no vehicle is driven down this road in quite some time, nor does it look to be made for vehicles to be driven down. And as you make your way down this long, isolated trail, you come upon a strange and wondrous place. One that you thought only lived in the storybooks and your mind's eye. A place that tiny roads wind through a tiny town, and dotting the side of these roads are small, diminutive homes made of stacked stone and mortared together with mud and clay. Their tiny roofs made from hand-cut timber and small, handmade clay tiles. You also notice small streetlights that hold large candles with glass globes that surround them in order to light the way for the residents of this town when the sun goes to hiding. There's only one problem, and that is that the residents do not want you here and will stop at nothing to drive you from their town. And if they are unable to do so, they will call upon their protector, or bouncer, if you will, of the city. A large albino creature that carries an axe and has a 12-gauge shotgun slung over its back. Some believe that this town was founded by the mistreated small people of sideshows and circuses, and that after fleeing modern society, due to the inbreeding to keep their numbers up, went completely feral, and in turn lost their minds. Now, with no way to relate, will do anything and everything in their power to keep their home safe. This story is just that, folks, a story. It has its origins traced back in Wisconsin's folklore to the 1950s. Although no one is 100% sure where it originated. And I keep saying story because, like I said, that's exactly what it is. A story told to keep kids and probably troublesome youth from running wild and roaming through the woods where the real danger could possibly hide. Now, it seems to be nothing more than an urban legend, but being a fan of this show, you already know that these stories all seem to have their base in some form of reality. That reality picks up here. See, when the Puritans came to the shores of New England back in the 17th century, they brought more than just religion and a new way of thinking to this country, but they also brought something easy to pack and easy to pass along to others. They brought their folklore. And in their folklore, there was more than just good and evil, light and dark, God versus Satan. There were tales of witches and ghosts, as these could have easily made the trip. See, the Puritans thought that a witch might be a strange neighbor whom they didn't know too well or had some secret vendetta against. And they believed in ghosts due to the death from hardship of the life back then and the amount of death that they'd been witness to while settling these areas. Then they didn't bring with them their fairy folk tales. And why did they leave that, you ask? Well, mainly because fairies were believed to reside in specific landscape features. Much like we all know of fairy mounds and the fairy realms and maybe even ancient buildings and castles. And when the Puritans left England, of course, they left that behind and they believed the fairies stayed there. But it should be noted that there were several New England writers whom commented on the lack of fairies in New England. One such writer was Sylvester Judge, a Unitarian minister of the 19th century, and he actually wrote, quote, "There are no fairies in our meadows and no elves to spirit away our children." Now, it seems that they learned of North American fey folk like the rest of the settlers. And that is from the Native Americans. The Mohegans tell of the Makaswag, the small beings who live under the Mohegan Hill in Connecticut. While the Passamaquoddy of Maine tell stories of the Nagwasak and the deadly Mekawasak. And the Penobscot have legends about small little helpful beings, yet called what? Wagamusak. As well as these dangerous little beings, these underwater dwarves. Stories about these fairy-like creatures, of course, were written down in the 19th century and passed along, but not really picking up and run with anyone. Maybe people believe due to the Native American languages that was so hard for the English speakers to pronounce, and even harder for some to read. But these stories also weren't about what the fae was believed to be by the English settlers. No, it wasn't beautiful fairies that rested upon a green hill. It was about small, hairy humanoids that were seen hiding in pools of water, in the dark trees and underbrush and scrub. These indigenous fairies, if you will, were what the Native Americans passed on to us. And in 1934, Miss Elizabeth Raynard published a book called The Narrow Land, Folk Chronicles of Old Cape Cod. And in that book, she told of her time she spent with a Wampanoag chieftain, Clarence Wixton, and the stories he told. And he actually used an Ojibwa term, and he described the fairies in that region to Miss Raynard as the Pukwudgie. Now, there's numerous pronunciations. Bagawajinwi, Pukwudgie, Pokwijimin, the Puk, Dawudjni, and on and on and on. Now, they are described as the little people, or these some sort of antagonists to the tribes, but they're magical little people of the forests in Algonquin folklore. And very similar to the European gnomes, the Pukwudgie stories are told throughout the northeastern United States, southern Canada, and even in the Great Lakes regions. Now, of course, they vary due to different tribes' folklore. But like we talked about, the Ojibwe of the Great Lakes tribes and their Pukwudgie stories, they tell of a very mischievous, but what they say is a good-natured, basically, creature who plays tricks on people, but it's not dangerous. But now, in the Northeast Algonquin tribes, they tell of stories that can be dangerous, but only to people that don't treat the Pukwudgie with respect. Which is much like what we've discussed in nature. Disrespect nature, and it disrespects you in return. In the Wampanoag tribes of southern New England, the Pukwudgies are dangerous creatures, but they are said to play harmless tricks on people and their neighbors, but they're likely to steal children or sabotage your plows and your crops. According to some of the stories, the Pukwudgies were enemies of a cultural hero to the Wampanoag called Mashop, and were even responsible for his death or even the death of his sons. See, the Wampanoag believed in a creation giant named Mashop. He was responsible for creating much of the land the tribe called home. And Mashop had a wife, and her name was Granny Squanet. And the tribe loved them, and they were very revered by the tribe. And they would bring them gifts and show much affection. But the Pukwudgie were jealous of Mashop, as all their efforts to be helpful to the Wampanoag usually backfired. So instead of being loved, they were considered nothing more than a nuisance. So rather than help the tribe, they decided to annoy them. Well, the story goes that things escalated very quickly, and the tribe turned to the creation giant, Mashop. Well, Mashop was asked to help rid the natives of these Pukwudgie, and Mashop gladly scooped up the little things, shook them about, and tossed them all around, killing many of them in the process. And it is said that the surviving Pukwudgie returned, and exacted their revenge not only on the tribe, by setting fires to their homes and kidnapping their children, and even luring many of the tribesmen to their death, but they also set their sights on Ma Shop and Granny Squanet. Well, Ma Shop, hating to see what happened to the tribe, got his wife and they went on a rampage to destroy as many Pukwudgie as they could. And the ones that got away, well, they just hid, they said, until Ma Shop finally died, or some stories say that they killed Ma Shop and his children. But the story goes deeper and says that they're usually described, they being the Pukwudgie, as knee-high or some smaller. Now, their name means person of the wilderness, or spirits of the forest. And what's strange is in some of these traditions and this folklore that they have a smell, and that smell is associated with flowers. It's a very sweet aroma that comes from the Pukwudgie. They're also said to have magical powers, in which that they can turn invisible, make people forget things, confuse them, shapeshift into other animals, or bring harm to anyone by simply staring at them. Christopher Balzano wrote a book called Dark Woods, Cults, Crime, and the Paranormal in Freetown State Forest. And in that book, there are two accounts of Pukwudgie encounters. In the first, there's a woman named Joan, and she claims she was walking her dog in the forest on a spring day in the early 1990s. And her dog ran off down the path and dragged her, of course, into the woods, like dogs do. And when the dog finally stopped, she found herself staring at a strange little being standing on a rock. Joan describes him as looking to her like a troll. Pale gray skin, 2 feet tall, hair on his arms and on the top of his head. And she says his torso made up the majority of his body, and he had very short legs. She goes on to say that his eyes were deep green, and he had large lips and long, almost canine-like nose. Joan, of course, was very shocked to see this creature, and it's staring back at her. Well, the dog finally panicked himself and ran away, and Joan, of course, following the dog, led her to safety away from what she considers to be a Pukwudgie. But there's another story from a fellow named Tom. And he said he saw the Pukwudgie when he was a teenager, that he had snuck out of his parents' home one evening to walk in the woods. Now, he says to clear his mind, but I'm sure being a teenager, it was just to get out and maybe do teenage things. And he says as he walked down the path, he saw a glowing light. And Tom said it looked like the form of a ball in front of him, and it was white, and it swelled. He said like it was breathing. He says it rose to about its shoulder height and then flew into the woods. Well, of course, Tom, being completely infatuated with this at the point, followed the light down the path until it disappeared. Says as he turned to head back home, he noticed that he was not alone. A short man stood in front of him, covered entirely in fur. Says he was about 2 feet tall and had the nose like a wolf. Says the man ran off into the trees with an unearthly moan. Now, he said the second time he saw a Pukwudgie was he was driving one night through Freetown State Forest. He said he got to the parking lots and he just sat in his car and turned off his engine and the headlights and turned the radio down low, just enjoying being by himself, when he realized he wasn't alone. He says standing in the darkness, staring at him, was the same little man he had seen in the woods, about 20 feet away. He could see its eyes glowing red in the middle of the darkness. Now, he said abruptly the engine of his car came on by itself and the radio started playing loudly. Well, in a panic and a tizzy from what he saw and the way the car was reacting, Tom slammed her into gear and, of course, got out of there. While doing a little more research into the Pukwudgie sightings, I found a few little forum writings, and in one of them was a fella from a bodybuilding forum. He says, I live in Pennsylvania, and my house is built on an old Seneca Indian tribe ground. He says, basically, these little troll creatures are linked to Native Americans. I'm not sure how or why, but they are. I know for a fact natives used to live here because as a kid, I found odd-shaped stones shaped like hammers in the creek behind my house, and also arrowheads in the cornfield up the road where me and some friends would go up there and loosen up the soil. So ever since I was a kid, I always felt like I was being watched while in my house and especially outside. I've basically been in a constant state of some type of paranoia ever since the age of 6. I've learned to accept it, though, now. As a child, I don't remember much, but here are some things I do remember happening. We would often camp in the backyard in tents for slumber parties and things, and one night, we just got done having marshmallows over the fire, and it was time to go to sleep. So I got up to walk over to the tent, and we see these little things that looked like elves or little gremlins run out of the tent as we approach it. Now, there was a whole pack of them. I couldn't make out the exact features of them at the time, but they were sure ugly little things, and from what I can remember, they had gray skin, long hair on their heads, and they were butt naked. Now, they walk or ran standing upright, just like you and I, and it was me and a friend who had seen them. The other people who were walking behind us, well, they didn't, and when we told them, they just laughed. I was probably around 9 years old or so, I think, but as I got older, it only got worse. I'd frequently encounter these little guys. The next time I remember seeing them, I think I was roughly 11, and it was on Christmas Eve. And that night I had decided to sleep downstairs and not in my room, I think because the furnace heat vent was plugged going into my room, so it was too cold to sleep there. But just as I was about to fall asleep, I heard something coming from the kitchen pantry that sounded like two things whispering back and forth. I was all alone downstairs, so I was pretty scared. The room I was in was creepy enough with this huge window facing the woods outside and no curtain covering it. I sat up real quick with my eyes wide open and the hair on the back of my neck standing up. I was in shock to what I was witnessing. It was real quiet and everybody was asleep, so I know it wasn't my parents or my older sister messing with me. At that moment, I basically gave myself two options: get up and investigate, or be a coward and run upstairs to Mom. So I slowly got up with my knees shaking vigorously from fear and entered the hallway. Made my way to the kitchen, ninja silent, and I could still hear this chattering as I came closer to the room. When I entered the doorway, looking into the kitchen, I heard all of the pots and pans that were hung in the pantry start falling left and right. It was loud as hell. I was basically freaking out inside, but I figured I'm already 3/4 of the way there, so I quickly ran over to the far right corner of the kitchen where the pantry was and flicked on the light fast as I could and screamed at the top of my lungs like a crazy person to scare whatever was in there. And again, there they were, those little trolls. Only two this time. It's a pretty long pantry that is built underneath the staircase. The shelves block off about half the staircase, and there is a tiny opening between the shelves, and that's where they ran into. I could barely see them, but I did. And still, the same things I remember were like the other story. But I did end up running upstairs afterwards like a little coward to my mother. Well, anyway, I haven't seen any of them in a long time, several years now. But I think I'm going to try to lure one out by thinking more about it more and more and more. That's kind of how it worked when I was younger. The more I thought about it, the more chances I'd have to see them. There was also some Pukwudgie encounters that came from Indiana. This encounter starts as Indiana's a boring place. It is your typical Midwestern state with corn, cows, and people who don't vote in their own self-interest. And there aren't many urban legends, ghosts, or anything else that scares you. The guy goes on to say, I was born and raised in Indiana, and those thoughts held true for me until recently, and I'm a reasonable person. I'm educated, skeptical, and not a believer in the paranormal. But what happened to me has kept me up at night, and I can't keep it to myself anymore. In college, I worked for the Department of Natural Resources in Indiana in the summer as a night security guard. The job was easy. I would drive around the park on patrols, respond to calls from campers, and sit at the front gate and surf the internet on slow nights. Along with me, a night gatekeeper would work there as well. The job at night was simple. Make sure no vandals got in and help out with any unruly campers. The park closed at 10 p.m., so only cars that had camping passes were allowed in and all the facilities were locked up. The park I was assigned to was called Mounds State Park. This park was home to 10 mounds that were used by Native Americans for ceremonies and their burial sites on the park. These mounds go back to 160 BC and had been very sacred for the tribes that called this area home. Now, the first time I became aware of some of the park's legends was after I had been there a week or two. It was from the night gatekeeper. I'll call her Carol. Carol was a sweet retired teacher who worked as a gatekeeper in the summer to make some extra cash. She would always give me some advice or show me the best route to do my patrols, or she even made working there not as lonely at night and was always great for good conversation. However, looking back, one conversation sticks out. It went something like this. "How do you like it here so far?" she said. "It's all right. An easy way to make some money for school," I replied. "Yeah, that it is. Well, what I thought when I started here is the same exact thing. I have worked at this park every summer since I was your age." She smiled, and I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" I asked, looking up from my laptop. "Well, the park may be small. There's more going on here than you would think." Her tone took a serious turn. I said, "Okay, you're freaking me out a bit." "Well, I'm not trying to scare you. I just wanted you to know and give you fair warning just in case." I said, "In case of what?" "You see them?" I said, "Who?" Now, this is how she explained it to me. "When you've been here as long as I have, you see some stuff that you can't explain. I used to be the night security guard like you a long time ago. It was great until around 96 when we had one of those large thunderstorms. In fact, the largest thunderstorm on record to come through. I got a visit from two of our campers after the storm. They said that they were kids in the woods playing with flashlights. It was making their dogs hysterical. I didn't think that any of our campers were that dumb to stay exactly through the storm, or that had any children with them. The camper said that they yelled at the kids and that they took off towards one of the great mounds deep in the woods. I figured it was simply local kids trying to scare the campers. I walked to the area of the great mound and immediately saw what they were talking about. In the distance, you could see little orbs of light, but not like a flashlight or a lantern. It reminded me of a giant bluish firefly. The orbs were about 2 to 3 feet above the ground and would move like someone was carrying them and disappear and reappear randomly. I counted about 10 of the orbs and decided that I was going to try and scare the kids off. It isn't by the book, but I wanted to get a good look at them so I could turn them into the police. It was a small community and chances are I would have to have the kids in class. The orbs looked to be about a half a mile in the forest. It was a pretty bright night, so I killed my flashlight and started creeping closer to the orbs. As I got closer, something didn't seem right. The forest was dead quiet, which can happen after a storm, but this was a different type of quiet. I was at least expecting giggling or to hear footsteps of the kids, but I heard neither. I was crouching behind a log about 100 yards away from the orbs, and I still couldn't see the outline of the kids. I kept looking and looking, but when my eyes adjusted, I saw something, well, that I still can't believe. I saw little hooded figures about 2 to 3 feet tall. The orbs were where the figures' faces should be. And it was the skin of the figures that was giving off the glow of the orbs. They also didn't seem to walk or crawl. They just kind of hovered. They didn't even disturb the leaves or the mud that they were on. They were putting something on the central area of the mound. I couldn't see what, but they were moving back and around, picking something up and putting it on the mound. Then they stopped and faced what they had put on the mound, and they started chanting. The chant was one of the weirdest sounds I have ever heard. It was a language, but it seemed to be more of a series of organized animal noises, like animals trying to talk. But the way it sounded, I knew it was some sort of language. And that's when I decided that whatever was going on in front of me was not worth being involved in. That's when I slowly crept away from the camp. And when I felt I was far enough away, I got up and sprinted to the gatehouse. And I immediately called the head park ranger on his home phone. I woke him up. He says, "Hello, who's this?" I said, "This is Carol. And there's something that I can't explain going on the Great Mound right now." And he says, "Well, slow down and tell me what you saw." There were these little things, people maybe, with glowing skin. They were wearing robes. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but they were performing a ritual or something at the Great Mound. I didn't know who to call. I figured you'd be the best person to talk to about this. The ranger said, he said calmly, "Did you interrupt them?" She says, "No, I got the hell out of there." He says, "Good. So the explanation for what you witnessed is hard to believe, but you seem trustworthy. It's time I let you know. The things you saw were not people. They were puckwudgies. They are ancient spirits of the forest that have been around before the mounds were built. They are not evil or good, per se. They are viewed as keepers of the forest. They can, however, torment those who interrupt their rituals. But mostly, they like to stay hidden and just make sure that the forest is safe and in balance. There have been sightings for as long as history has been recorded around here." Carol said that he paused, and then following, saying in a very monotone voice, "Please keep them a secret. We do not want people looking for them. This would disrupt the balance of the forest, and they would not be happy." And Carol said, she asked, "Well, what do you mean torment?" Says they've been known to play tricks on people or haunt them. They can follow someone who disrupts them or the forest home. They stop this once you return what you disrupted to how it has been before. He goes on to say that they were probably doing the ritual to do the storm, and then after all the trees and the floods and it happened in the park, that was kind of the result of it. He said it's no big deal. Just don't go back looking for them. "You don't have to worry about that," she said. "Can I be switched to a gatekeeper? I do not want to go out there on patrol again, especially at night." And he said, "That's fine, done. Just don't tell everyone what you saw on patrol." So he hung up the phone. And I asked, "So why are you telling me this?" "Well, not to alarm you, but tomorrow is supposed to be a big storm. And you were the night watchman scheduled for tomorrow. I like you, and I did not want you to walk into something that you knew nothing about." And with Carol's reassuring voice, I think she meant it, and I appreciated the concern, but now I thought one of my only friends on this job was crazy. I said, "Thank you, and I will do my best to stay away from any weird calls." The next day around 5 o'clock, the area received once in a century thunderstorm. It was bad enough the tornado sirens went off. Multiple reports of funnel clouds. So in case you didn't know, state parks in Indiana rarely shut down. He says basically a meteor would have to hit the state for me to get an unscheduled day off. So I got to my shift around 8 p.m. When I arrived, power was already off. Carol had the night off, and some young guy I hadn't seen before was working the gate. I stopped the gate in my patrol truck, checked in. Guy's name was Steve. Seemed nice enough, college kid. I asked if he had any incidences in the park. He said no, that no one was in the park tonight due to the storm and the flooding. Even all the campers left the campgrounds to stay safe. So that news made me happy. No campers to report incidences meant a drama-free night for me. I did my initial patrol and saw nothing unusual. However, the storm had caused a lot of damage to trees in the park. I went back to the gatehouse, chatted with Steve in the lantern light. Then the park ranger called the park landline. Steve picked up the phone. The ranger said, "Yeah, I'll tell him." That was the park ranger. He said that he lost his keys to the park out by the Great Mound bathrooms. He was in a rush to get in before the storms and must not have clipped them to his belt in a hurry. "Would you go look by the bathrooms and get them?" He said that's the only place that they could be, and we need to get them before anyone comes to the park tomorrow. Dang, I thought to myself, all right, no problem. and took off. I drove out to the Great Mound and got out. Of course, it was darker than normal due to the power being out. Now, usually, I didn't have a flashlight. I didn't have to use a flashlight, but tonight, without one, I couldn't see my hand in front of my face. Walked over to the bathrooms, looked everywhere for the keys. They are not there. Shined my flashlight in the area and inside the Great Mound. I saw something shining laying in the middle. I said, dang. So I headed over to see what this shiny thing was. I walked into the inner circle of the mound, pointed my flashlight onto the middle, and saw the keys and something terrifying. Some sort of shrine or altar with the keys in the middle of it. The shrine had a deer skull with antlers, some feathers attached to a stick figure, all of it tied together with some vines, various rocks, and the keys were below all of this. Just someone being funny. Get the keys and get the hell out, I told myself. That's when my flashlight went dead. I kept trying to turn it on, but it was like the battery had magically been drained. Impossible. I have not even turned the thing on all summer. I put new batteries in it when I started working here, I said under my breath. Then a glow illuminated from behind me. Then another glow. To my left, then to my right, then eventually all around me. I looked up and saw them standing there, all atop the outer ring. The Pukwudgies, exactly as described. I could see their faces from the inside of their robes, pointed ears, pointed noses, black eyes, glowing bluish-gray skin, tiny hands. They just stood there staring at me. I started backing away from the inner mound. They pointed at me. I yelled out, I need these. They are for the park. They will help us keep the park safe. They did nothing but point. I kept backing out, and then I started sprinting. And when I got to the outer circle, they stood there pointing, even as I was running to the truck. I looked back to see if they were following me, but they weren't. They had moved to the center to check their shrine, and I could see them look up at me. I got into the truck, drove back to the gatehouse. Or that was my plan, anyway. See, the truck wouldn't start. It wouldn't even turn over. I just said no, 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 over and over. I got out and started running towards the gatehouse now. I looked over my shoulder, and they still were not chasing me, just standing there, looking at me as I ran. I burst into the gatehouse, scared the hell out of Steve. He asked me if everything's okay. Alarmed, I said, yeah, I got the keys back, but my truck is dead. I ran here from the Great Mound. I saw some coyotes or something on the mound, and I panicked. That's why I sprinted here. Okay, nice to know some coyotes got to the person where we're trusting with our security, but glad you found the keys. The power came back on shortly after that. I waited in the gatehouse until morning. When the park ranger came to the park, I gave him his keys, told him about what I saw. He laughed it off and said I shouldn't be talking to Carol. It told me that he was one of the night watchmen after her, and she warned him about the same thing, and he drove me down to where my truck was parked, and I jumped in the truck. We jumped it off. Got it rolling. He just rolled his eyes at me and drove off. I went around to the mound to investigate. What I saw terrified me more than what I saw the last night. There were no footprints where the Pukwudgie has been, but there were hoof prints going up to the mound and from the mound to the forest. They looked like large deer tracks, but they was only been on 2 feet. They led to the inner mound and then back out and then disappeared. The mound also had a weird coppery, skunky smell to it. I think the Pukwudgies were keeping something from coming into the park, something very bad that would disrupt the balance. That's why they had their rituals right after the big storms. I've had the worst luck since that night. My cars always break down, my hard drives keep going bad, stuff goes missing. I've tried chalking it up to bad luck, but deep down I know that I'm being punished for disrupting the ritual that night and unleashing something onto the world. I don't know what to do next, but I'm thinking that I will get those keys back to them and hopefully stop whatever I have done.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I love these stories of the little people, the Pukwudgie, the Fae folk, whatever it is. Interesting stories. I mean, like that, the last two stories you just read.
Little Shaman.
Yeah, I mean, and it seemed to me like the director or the guy's supervisor or whatever was like, he was aware of it. He's like, yeah, that's what those are. You know, they've been there forever and, you know, just don't disturb them. And yeah. They're there to make sure there's a balance in the forest.
I've had that story for a while. Adam, thank you for sending it to me. That was awesome. I've had that thing emailed to me for a while and I've been like, man, I need to build a story around it. Because when I first read it, it's the same thing. The first thing I could think of is what you're talking about is like somebody knows about it. People aren't seeing it. If it's all on the up and up, if it's all a legit story, you know, if this right. is a real thing, if that's how it goes and this really happened to somebody, I don't know. But it... I like the fact of what they, what is it? Is it Dobby? What is that thing from Harry Potter? You know, the little bitty elf guy, one of the Harry Potter things. That's the first thing I picture when they start talking about it. Cause it's kind of got right. like a big nose, not really a long face, but a larger nose. He's kind of, you know, leathery looking, things like that. But then they start talking about him being like a little shaman. Or maybe they are. That's what it is little keepers of the woods. And that kind of goes along with more of, if
I like that idea though. That's cool.
Yeah. Everything, it seems like every time you cover any stories of the little people, it always is that they're in tune with nature. We've covered numerous of these stories, and something about the Fae folk just always seemed to be my favorite. But I can't imagine seeing what he saw, little bitty tiny creatures doing some sort of religious ritual or ceremony.
Seance or something. Yeah,
dude, there's no way. But like you said, it's people know about it. They're just keeping it hush. Okay. Let's say this is all 100% legit. Even part of it, but let's say this is 100% legit. Wouldn't that explain some of the things that happen to people in these national forests and things with the missing 411? Just like Possible. We talked about. Maybe there's not just one, but it's multiple things. Maybe it's those people, it's Bigfoot encounters, it's Dogman encounters, it's time slips, it's time, you know. Maybe there are multiple things that go on in these areas. And like I've said before, what if all these national parks and stuff were actually turned into that for a reason?
Right.
So people can't get too close to it. So it limits the number of people there instead of people moving into it because they know that these areas hold something special.
I kind of like that story. I mean, like, I'm going to tell my kids that too. Like, you know, if the Pukwudgies are watching and they see you littering when we're camping, throwing, you know, food wrappers and stuff right? on the floor and stuff, that you know, they may come and get you.
Exactly.
Be on the level, right? I hope that's true because that is cool. I like the idea of somebody not doing right
of them
in the woods
and yeah.
them like, you know, not, you know, destroying you.
You don't got to kill them.
Right.
Just,
yeah.
Maybe a little bad luck.
Pester them.
Yes.
Make their photos not develop on their phone or you know what I mean? Just
yeah.
like the guy was talking about his hard drive. He's always having little problems and he knows it's because of what he did.
Cars are breaking down. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a flat tire this last week and so did you.
Yeah, I know.
Maybe
right?
it's for making fun of Pukwudgies.
Maybe it was, yeah, for the research and the making fun of Pukwudgies. There's something else I want to touch on, folks. When I was down in Galveston, if you're ever down in that area, if you ever go on any kind of vacation down in that area, you go to Galveston, there is a store on Post Office Street. The address is 2116. The name of the store is The Witchery. And the greatest thing is when I caught it, I looked, it says The Witchery and all this fancy writing. And on it, it says Purveyors of Fine Esoteric Goods. Now, you can check it out at witcheryonline.com. It was awesome. I go in there. They have got everything in there. All kinds of books that we all would love. All kinds of everything, man. I talked to Clyde, the guy behind the counter. We were chatting. They got all kinds of like amulets, tarot cards, all kinds of, you know, pagan books and Wicca books and paranormal and ancient history. I mean, it's books. It there's everything in there. I mean, it's any kind of stones you can imagine, necklaces, bracelets. It is all amazing, awesome stuff. So he was a great guy. Got some few things while he was in there. The store is awesome. If you're ever down that way in Galveston or you're just hanging out there close, you live in Houston, want to make a cool little run down there, go check out The Witchery.
That's cool.
It's a cool store. You checking it out?
No, I mean,
cool
it sounds
store.
Cool. I mean, I'm just imagining in my mind
oh,
eye what
so
it would
neat.
Look like. Yeah,
it was so neat. And I want to touch on something else that Kyle was brought up on the Elite Show. We were talking about Rio's trouble they were having with Olympic diving pool. Everything was crystal clear, and then one of them turned into a lake.
Yes.
Right? Well, it says here, this is again from Gizmodo right here. Says, for nearly a week now, a mystery has surrounded the Olympics, and it wasn't what country would reign supreme. It was, why did those pools turn green?
Right, yeah.
Says, officials have run the gamut on possible explanations, including algae bloom, a chemical imbalance caused by too many people using the pool. But now Olympic officials are handing out a final verdict.
Okay.
He goes on to say that what caused these pools which should have been all prepared for the Summer Olympics, but weren't, to turn into, of course, this murky color. Somebody made a mistake. I'm like, well, no jokes.
Well, obviously, mistake, right?
It says, according to the New York Times, somebody accidentally added 160 liters of hydrogen peroxide on August 5th to the pool used for diving, which neutralized the chlorine and caused it to turn green, basically eliminating the chlorine allowed for the growth of organic compounds, which that's all it is, algae. It's an algae colored stuff.
How do you accidentally introduce 160 gallons?
Yeah, 160 liters to it. Yeah. Now, of course, it says can be used. Hydrogen peroxide can be used as a cleaning agent for pools, but not when combined with chlorine. It neutralizes it. And of course, we knew all that stuff. But now he goes in and he starts talking about it. And they actually interviewed a fellow named Gustavo, and he's the director of venue management there for the Rio Olympics. And he talked about it. He said the monitors did pick up the chlorine, but failed to notice that it was no longer working. That's really not how this works, but I'll go ahead and let him talk about it like that.
Yeah, Gustavo, you're fired.
Yeah. Well, you're talking about when you pick it up. It may have picked up some chlorine, but when you're reading, it depends on what chlorine you're reading, but when you're doing a chlorine reading, chlorine, when it goes away, it can actually turn into something. It causes nitrification. When chlorine breaks down, it turns into a free ammonia, and that's where you start watching these so you don't start getting nitrification in your systems. So when he's picking up chlorine, you should instantly know, man, the chlorine numbers are way lower than what they should be. Instantly, you would know that. You would look and go, look, it's supposed to be this, and it's this.
If you know what you're doing,
the balance
you notice
is
that.
Off. Exactly. And then, of course, they said right before the synchronized swimming event on this past Sunday, it says where the athletes were going to need, of course, to see each other underwater, they were planning on draining the 3.7 million liter pool and replacing it with the water from the practice pool. But now it's back to the correct color. They did a little messing around with it. Boom, it came right back. And it says officials are, of course, embarrassed by this whole thing. It says, of course, it's an embarrassment. This is Mario Andrada, the spokesman for the Rio Games. It says, we are hosting the Olympic Games and athletes are here, so water is going to be an issue. We should have been better at fixing it quickly. Yeah. We learned a painful lesson the hard way. Now, they did fix it. But there's also been all kinds of stuff going on down there in the Rio Olympics. It's just been dangerous from the go, it seems like, down there. So, I don't know. Like we talked about people being robbed, people being mugged, people on the beach, and these are Olympic athletes. They're like, oh, that's great.
Right? I mean, I just saw that where volunteers aren't even showing up, okay? Every host country that holds one of these Olympics, holds the Olympics, they ask for volunteers, okay? These people are not getting paid. They said 240,000 people applied to be volunteers during the Rio Olympics, okay? And by being a volunteer, you get an outfit, you get like a raincoat, you get a free wristwatch, you get all this stuff. Well, guess what? Everybody that volunteered came and got their workout stuff and their wristwatches and stuff. But guess what?
Never came back.
Almost none of them come back. They said only 70,000 of the 240,000 volunteers are actually showing up to do their jobs.
Wow.
I mean, come on.
Come
and
on, man.
Some of them are complaining, saying, well, we're not getting paid to do this. And like, well, that's what volunteer means.
You went into it knowing what the word volunteer was.
And what makes things worse, they said in the Olympics, when the Olympics were held in Australia,
yeah.
Every single volunteer that applied showed up and worked the entire thing. That they had more people were turning away volunteers. These people had no problem. So what is going on? They can't get people to do the pools right. They can't get people to just volunteer to help out. Look, man,
that's just sad.
You know, Brazil appears to be a beautiful country, but what is going on? This is not making them look very good to me, right? It doesn't look good.
The Olympics has not made Brazil look good at all.
It has not shined a good light on
the
town,
not at
right?
all. Yeah, I feel bad for them.
I do too.
I really do, because it's one of those things you try, and then, but also too, I say I feel bad for the Brazilians in the fact that they were just throwing people out of their home, bulldozing homes to build all this, and so it's been mishandled from the jump. But
it has. The people didn't even want it to come there, the locals. You know?
I'm not getting into that. I just feel bad for people. All the way around.
I do too. It seems like a few bad apples is ruining it. For
it
everybody
does.
Of that
it
city,
does.
You know?
Yeah, it does.
You know, with the muggings and stuff. I'm sure the normal person who lives in Rio de Janeiro is probably a great, you know, kind person.
Of course.
But just like every city, right?
Yes.
But anyways, tragic. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
I'm loving the cooler weather. We've been dealing with the little storms through here. Folks, everybody in Louisiana, please, man, be careful down there. They've getting what we got earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Flooding, loss of life, the whole thing. Y'all be careful. Look, if it's flowing water, looks deep, don't go that way. Real simple. Don't drown. Turn around.
That's right.
And that's real. That is real. But yeah, other than that, that's it. Just going to get in there, do some grinding. Got a lot of stuff I got to cover from work after being gone all last week. You know, I'm monkeying around and doing all that stuff. So just playing catch up. My daughter's going to be 16 in a couple of weeks. Now I got to go look for vehicles. And she's, you know, all the kids start school down here in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, I mean, it's we're getting ready to wrap up summer, I guess, if you will, and get back to the groove.
Well, I got one more hoorah before summer's over. I've got a short week this week because me and the family, we're going south. We're going to a water park. We're going to hang out. We're going to go hang out in Austin for a couple days.
There you go. You're going to the Schlitterbahn while you're down there?
We're going to the Schlitterbahn. Oh. We're going to go to an aquarium nearby. It's going to be a lot of fun.
It'll be good times. Yeah, it'll be good times.
So I'm looking forward to that. Well, everybody stay safe out there. Please be careful. Give someone a hug. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.